With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Hello and welcome to the Undercut Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jesse Billington, and we're back to review the fourth race of the Formula One 2024 season, the Japanese Grand Prix. And to do this, I'm joined by my regular co-hosts, Mr. Timo Albers-Daly and Miss Ellie Mae Taylor. How are you?
Tired.
We're recording a little bit later than usual, so I think that's quite fair. We've pushed it back because, of course, we've got a guest as well. But Timo, how are you before we jump onto that?
I'm good, thank you. It's a curious case of boring Grand Prix action-wise, but interesting for other reasons. I'm kind of not sure what to do with that.
It wasn't particularly sparkling on track, but it's got some interesting repercussions. And as we mentioned, we've got a guest, and for the third podcast in a row now, so certainly setting records here, joined again by lower lap times Martin Villari. How are you?
Yeah, well, thanks. We'll see how long that lasts, hey? So we've got some late races coming up, but looking forward to dissect the Japanese Grand Prix. A lot to talk about from a strategy point of view. So, yeah, going well, thank you.
Yeah, certainly a good one to have you on as a guest for. And, well, we'll dive into it. Usually this would be the point where we have some news, but there hasn't really been any news across the weekend of the Japanese Grand Prix. It was all fairly quiet. Omu Iwasa had an FP1 drive, and then everything proceeded from there. Of course, we had a bit of wet running early on in the practice sessions. So we'll dive straight into the race, really, as there's not a huge amount of news to unpack. And straight away from lights out, Ricciardo clips Albon and spins, sending Albon into the barriers with him. Off the second start, Verstappen suffers with wheel spin through the mid phase of the launch, but gets away well. Then the rest of the race is sort of an ongoing strategy battle, really, with many teams opting to drop their first start tyres and push longer from there. Alonso, Norris, Verstappen, Perez, Piastri, Hülkenberg, and Bottas all stuck with their initial compounds, though, which is an interesting one. Some of them as well were sticking with mediums, some of them were sticking with softs to try and capitalize on the packed grid off the restart. The lap 22 pit stops, though, were really the big deciders for the tail end of the points, with four drivers, Tsunoda, Stroll, Magnussen, and Bottas all pitting at once. And then towards the end, Verstappen cruised to a victory, and he, Perez, and Tsunoda were able to take a cool-down lap in flying formation. But there's a lot more to it than that, so we'll pick this apart by teams, and we'll kick off with Red Bull, probably the easiest ones to start with. So, Timo, we'll go for your opinion on Red Bull's performance across the weekend.
Really, no notes on Verstappen, but pretty much take care of itself at this point. But Perez is where it gets interesting, because he got a lot of praise over the weekend, and it was kind of curious to see in some regards, because it goes back to him obviously being a good Grand Prix driver, otherwise he wouldn't have lasted this long in the sport as he has. And he has had a pretty good start this year with 3 second places out of 4 races, which it backs that up. And it's his best string of results since kind of Monza last year. He only got P3 in Vegas as his last time on the podium last year. So he's really started off with a good solid start results-wise. But then you look at all 4 races and the gaps to first place are quite redonkulous. And it's kind of just bad and worse. I mean, look at 22.5 seconds Bahrain, 13 seconds in Saudi Arabia. So still better, but also awful. Nearly a minute in Australia, admittedly he was in P5, not in P2, but still, when Verstappen's out of the game at that point, he's meant to be the one picking up those wins, or at least being still on the podium. And then, okay, Japan, 12.5 seconds, weirdly getting praise on Sky. I'm not sure if they were just delirious from the time of the morning that it was on for UK people or what, but it was still this weird thing of, yeah, it's great that at P2, but he's not going to be challenging Max at all by the looks of things, which is perfect for Red Bull, but it kind of brings back this whole thing of he's one of those drivers that whilst he's good, he seems to still Well, not still. I think he probably had it at some point. He seems to have lost that passion and heart that it is needed to take that step up and become a top-tier driver. So he's perfect for Red Bull in that second position, and he's having a good time with it on paper, but I feel like it's both good, it's both weird and not weird to praise him at the same time.
He sort of resigned himself to the paychecks, really, of just sort of, if I can just come in second every time, I'll get the happy paychecks. I'm still an F1 driver. Life is good. It's sort of
an interesting location. He bought us when he was at Mercedes for me. He's kind of, he started off going, I'm in a top team. I'm going to go off and I'm going to go and take the fight to the man and I'm going to beat him. And then he doesn't. And he goes, I'll try again next year. And then there's a shorter time span where the man, in this case Verstappen, beats him down. And last year, it was done after Saudi Arabia. It didn't really happen anything much after that. And this year, it's kind of like, I'm going to come second as often as I can. That's my new plan. And it's kind of like, you've been defanged somewhat. And it's perfect for Red Bull. He's doing everything he needs to do to keep his seat there for next year, because you and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, Martin. He isn't doing anything to rock the boat there. Whereas anyone new coming in, regardless of who they are, there's going to be that initial Perez feeling there of, I'm going to come in and take it to the man. Where it's like, well, why would we bother replacing him then if he's doing exactly what we need him to? We've tamed him down, we've neutered him, and he does exactly what we want him to do. Max is happy, team's happy, we're still coming second in the Drivers' Championship, we still win the Constructors, Max is happy. Job done.
I guess the more positive way to look at it is that he was only a fraction sort of behind Verstappen in qualifying. And yes, he ultimately was 12 seconds behind Verstappen when he finished the race, but he did kind of have more overtaking to do in the race, which I guess hurt his tyres more. So he wasn't quite able to sort of look after them like Max did. And I think as well, when you look at kind of, when you want to improve on things, you don't immediately then, you know, look at where he was last season. At the end of the season, he wasn't particularly close to Max. He's not going to suddenly jump in improvement that he's completely on it. I think that's probably, I don't know, from my side, expecting too much of him. It's probably going to be a slow kind of, hopefully it's a slow growth that he then slowly improves, right, and he then maybe brings it to Max, or at least a lot closer than 22 seconds like he was in Bahrain.
I think you're probably still optimistic about Perez improving over the course of a year. I think he's kind of, I don't think he was going to jump out the box like Bottas would do at the start of a season, have a great start and then taper off. I think he's just this year, I think he's very resigned to the fact that he knows he's not going to beat Max, so he's going to maximize it. And as close as you might be in qualifying, at the end of the day, as fun as it is to watch in qualifying, it means jack shit. Because if you don't actually convert that to anything and improve during the race, no one remembers where you qualify. I mean, as fun a statistic as it is for Hamilton to have 100 plus pole positions, no one cares about that. They care about the wins. They care about the results on Sunday. And even though he had more of a taking to do, it's kind of that whole strategy of being the second driver that was going to put him there anyway, because there's no need for them to rock the boat and try and do something daring with him to get him to overtake Max.
I think he's found a form where he's quite happy, and ultimately I think Red Bull are quite happy with the form he's producing. If he is getting that second in qualifying, and if he's coming home second in the race, they don't care about the margin.
As long as he's second,
it's fine. Martin, what are your thoughts really on sort of Red Bull's performance then across the weekend?
Yeah, firstly, the only team to execute a clean strategy, in my opinion. So I'll get on to that later. So I know it's a lot easier to do at the front, but they've had a plan and they've stuck to it. So Hannes Schmitz, the strategist there, always doing a good job. I think Red Bull strategies are, you know, generally speaking, the best on the grid. So that's the first thing. And yeah, Perez did exceed my expectations, particularly in qualifying. Like you say, Ellie, so close to Max on like a higher downforce Max technical circuit, like he could have easily taken pole there, and things would have been very different. But to pick up on your point, Timo, yeah, at the start of the season, it's true that the good drivers like Max and Hamilton and so on, they're still kind of finding their way through the car. And like Checo could pick up a win early in Monaco, he picked up a win early in Baku before, he was close here with this one. So as the season goes on, you know, we generally see like divergence between the drivers. So let's keep an eye out for that. But a good strategy, strong performance by both drivers. You know, there's not much to complain about there.
I think my sort of overriding notes really for Red Bull were very much exactly as expected. Nothing truly exciting, just raw competence. And I think sort of it's wholly embodied from the performance from both their drivers, from their strategy, from their pit teams, their ability to just put together a performance that is sort of unwavering in its ability to do everything it needed to do with no sort of unnecessary flamboyance. So a similar case of we come, we do the job, we race perfectly, we go home. And that's almost what you want from a top performing F1 team. It'd be great if we had other teams that are able to do that. But
it's also the fifth consecutive Japanese Grand Prix with a winning margin of over 10 seconds, which is just interesting that we'll start considering only three of those were Max Verstappen. There's still two more before that where it was there. So it's interesting that whoever is the winning team there, they pull up what is a pretty sizable gap on whoever's in second place.
It's a technical circuit that if you get it right, you get it right. And if you haven't got things completely lined up, it can start to bite and you'll start to suffer on it. And that does actually lead us quite nicely into the next team on the roster, which is Ferrari. And I'll kick off with mine, which is quite optimistic, being a bit of a Ferrari fan. And I'll say, given the fact that their track record has always been absolutely obliterating tyres through heat degradation, they didn't do that so much this weekend. It was quite sunny. There was relatively high track temperatures compared to what they're used to in Suzuka. And they performed relatively well. It's a marked improvement of the SF24 over its predecessors. Certainly, it's still not the best in the field. But it made the car a lot more drivable over a longer period and gave them a chance to put their drivers on alternate strategies, whether they were truly the correct choices for that race and that weekend. But it was sort of a far more sort of useful tool to try and play different strategies with.
I definitely think it was interesting that they did do that split strategy. I almost think that that wasn't their plan initially. I think because they knew that they weren't going to catch Red Bull and McLaren and Mercedes weren't really matching Ferrari's pace, they were able to almost keep the strategy that they had always planned with Carlos, which in hindsight, you know, was the quicker strategy. But, you know, just in case that one-stop strategy with Mercedes did work and the race wasn't hard on the tyres as anticipated, and, you know, Mercedes were able to save sort of the 22 seconds and not doing that second pit stop, they're able to put Leclerc on that one-stop strategy and they kind of had nothing to lose. Charles, you know, was eighth in qualifying and finished in fourth, so it didn't really do any harm to them, and they were then able to actually carry it out better than sort of Mercedes planned and then obviously didn't go through with it.
I know, Martin, you've sort of picked apart Ferrari's strategy here and you've got some interesting bits on our sort of big list of notes. So I'll let you dive into those.
Yeah, I think the quali pace wasn't strong, obviously, and the race pace was very strong. So both Ferraris came through and it kind of looks like everything went well. Leclerc, midway through his stint, made the call, tyres are feeling good, I want to do a one stop. So that's fine. But the issue I have is the time both the drivers pitted, they were completely out of tyres and they both made two mistakes towards the end of their stint. I think Leclerc locked up and went wide at Degna 2 on his in-lap. So he was just completely out of tyres. And we've seen in 2022 in Paul Ricard, that's a race-ending mistake. Like, that can be a race-ending mistake when you just leave your driver out there on a completely dead set of tyres. So he's done 26 laps on the medium and 26 laps on the hard. It's also very unusual. Normally you'd shorten the medium stint and then extend the harder stint. So like 23:30, it's probably a better split. It's so much safer. And it's also a faster race time. So very dangerous there. And then Sainz, they've got 21 laps on an old set of mediums, who also on his in-lap or one lap before his in-lap locked up into the final chicane and went deep as well. So you got to be careful with stuff like that. He's done 21 laps on an old set, like a scrub set of mediums, and Leclerc's done 26 on mediums. So both of them did the longest run on their mediums and it showed the drivers were just out of grip at the end. So firstly, it wasn't the quickest way around to bring them in two or three laps earlier. Is the quickest way around. And secondly, the risk around Japan, you know, that could easily be race ending for Charles at Degna 2. And Carlos at the chicane wasn't too bad. But if that's other tracks like Monaco or something, or like we saw in Paul Ricard, there are examples of them leaving Charles out there to suffer and crash. They need to cut that out.
Yeah, you get to something like Hungary, where it's a tight technical demanding circuit and the walls are close. The last thing you want is to really be extending a stint just sort of that one or two laps beyond the tire's comfortable range.
Yeah.
Team, I'll leave you.
Sorry, I was just going to pick up and say it wasn't necessary, and it's not something that happens. I mean, the tires do wear gradually, but when they're gone, they're gone, and the driver's made two mistakes there. So it catches you by surprise as well. The temperature falls out of the tire. Also, Suzuka was getting colder, you know, across the race. So it just, there were two mistakes at the end of their stint there. So very important for me, because they could be race-ending mistakes.
It'll be interesting to see how Ferrari evolve their strategies moving forwards, taking forward what they've possibly learned from Suzuka on sort of the absolute upper limit on those compounds on that style of circuit. Ellie May.
I was just going to say, do you think that in that case they were kind of lucky in the fact that Mercedes and McLaren weren't there on strategy and pace?
Correct.
Correct.
Those mistakes would have cost them positions if Mercedes and McLaren were also on point with their strategy. Yep.
Timo, I'll let you wrap up for
building off what Martin was saying, but then kind of siding with you on the optimism front, Jesse, that they got lucky to an extent that McLaren and Mercedes weren't there, but looking at their qualifying pace from McLaren and Mercedes being what they are at the moment, I think they could afford to take that risk and for it to pay off. I mean, they're really maximising their potential and sort of emulating Fernando Alonso, but as a team, in terms of just, we know we're not going to be able to beat Red Bull here this weekend, so what is it that we can do? Leclerc had what he described as one of the worst qualifying sessions of his career, and you get one of those once a season if you're in that kind of position, or quite regularly if you're down the bottom of the grid. And so I quite enjoyed the fact that there was no bullshit between two of them when it came to Sainz having to get past Leclerc. That could have easily been a tit-for-tat thing, as we often, at least here on the radio with other teams, never mind then it being put into practice with unnecessarily delayed overtaking with one car to another. And it just kind of, they maximized what they were able to do here with the potential. Sainz has got his 100% record of finishing on the podium in every race that he's been in this year. Leclerc hasn't finished below P4. They got on with the job in hand and just kind of sorting out whatever issues. And they did have a couple of issues, but it was a place they could afford to make it. And they're going to know that they got away with it. And so when it comes to somewhere like Monaco or somewhere like Budapest, they know that they can't afford to do that. And by that point, who knows how much McLaren and Mercedes and even Aston Martin will have evolved and be able to catch them up. So I think, luck to a certain extent, but at least for once with Ferrari, it was good luck in a weirdly disguised way.
And it was brought around by a level of competence we've sort of long wanted to see back in Ferrari. On the flip side of that coin, though, was Mercedes. And team, I'll open with your points because yours are pretty short and sweet.
Pretty sure I've started my Mamma Mia trilogy here, haven't I?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to preemptively agree with Martin from what I've seen in the notes there. It's just essentially all they've done in the race is swapped Hamilton and Russell around after Lewis had a bit of understeer after a little bit of very brief contact with Leclerc early doors. And if they had a strategy, no one knew what it was, including the drivers and the teams. And you could hear the pain in Hamilton's voice over the radio at various points. It's like, what are we doing? Why do we need to do this? And him then just coming out and being a team player and going, oh, I'm buggered anyway. Will I just let George pass and get this all sorted? And I mentioned this in the preview, I think, in terms of him happily taking on the new components to the car to be the experimental guinea pig. And I do like that he's still got that dedication and loyalty to Mercedes, but at the same time, it can't be fun having to put up with it during a Grand Prix and still be like, how the hell did I win as many races and titles with this team? When what's happened here? And it's just a bit of a head scratcher and not in a very good way.
Martin, I'll let you talk about their strategy then, because that seems to have been Timo's sort of big bug.
Do you know what it was?
So they've obviously tried the one stop. It hasn't worked. They've tried to take advantage of the red flag and put the drivers on the hards. I was listening to James Allison's Australian race debrief, and they started Lewis on the soft tire in that race, hoping to get something like we got in Japan, an early safety car, so that then they could do exactly what they did in Japan, which is then flip over to the hards and run two sets of hards. So it's something that they've got in their minds that they, for some reason, and if they did do that in Australia, you're at the back of the grid, firstly, because you're pitting under safety car. No one else is pitting. If there's a lap one safety car, you're at the back of the grid. You're on a hard tire. How is that a good strategy? How is that a good thought or good strategy? I'm not sure. So they've tried it here. It's a little bit better with the red flag because at least you're not on the back of the grid. So they started in their, you know, their grid slots. But it's just not a racy strategy either. Like, it's, you've got to remember, we brought the hardest compounds possible to Japan. And then they've picked to go double hard. Like, it's a bit of a long shot. And then not only did they not even execute on that strategy, like to do a double hard would have been maybe okay. But then they've also said, oh no, stuff this, we'll stick the medium on at the end for both our drivers. And they've done like a really compromised two-stop strategy in the end. So yeah, the idea to do it in the first place, I think they need to change that. Go for something more racy, go medium, medium soft, or medium, medium hard, or like try something a little bit more aggressive and try to get up. We saw a lot of soft runners try, you know, had good traction out of turn one and we're starting to attack. So they've just got to put themselves in a more racy position, I think. But yeah, both drivers, Hamilton said he had massive understeer and let George through. So for me, it was a big downer on all fronts again, following the double DNF in Melbourne.
It's very much the sort of flip to Ferrari's gamble that just about worked for Mercedes. This was sort of a thought through strategy that just completely didn't. And it wasn't what they needed at the time. They were obviously looking to try and get data out of Lewis's car with experimental parts and sort of development pieces being put into play. And it's not working. It meant they got to run a fairly sort of lonely race to some extent, but at the same time,
suppose the only silver lining is that whilst they've done this massive overhaul with the car and in the hopes of improving it, they've more or less just been exactly where they were last year, but just ever so slightly worse, but not detrimentally worse. They've not done an Alpine, for example, and gone, we need to radically change this, and we really screwed this. So at least they're still picking up some points, which is crucial when they're not slipping too far down the order. But again, it's really a kind of British reference time, Channel 5 scraping the bottom of the barrel sort of silver lining way of looking at things.
Channel 5 doing their fourth documentary on air fryers in as many weeks, sort of scraping the bottom of the barrel, which is an incredibly niche reference that only British television enjoys will ever get. But I think there was some sort of small glimmers of hope with Mercedes. I think certainly their final pit stops towards the end, it proved just about right for Russell. I think it's more a case of Russell's sort of ability to fight through things a bit more. He's sort of just a bit more willing to just sort of send one up the inside and see what happens. And that's paid off on Piastri, who was sort of clinging on to the back of Alonso towards the end and making the most of sort of, again, Alonso's big brain driving, just sort of thinking about the broader picture, keeping Piastri there as sort of in Mario Kart, when you carry a banana around behind you to act as sort of a buffer zone to any attacks from the rear, very much the same concept. And it paid off for Alonso in the long run, even at the cost of Piastri. But Ellie Mae, you've got a question for everyone about Mercedes.
Yeah, do you think that their strategies are perhaps still a fallout from the previous regulation era? So excluding maybe 2021, Mercedes, especially Lewis, was obviously pretty dominant. Lewis could finish races with a healthy gap in the lead. And whilst you always had Lewis coming on the radio going like, Bono, my tyres are gone, the Mercedes was still pretty good on its tyres, or they could sometimes stay out and go through that hard graining phase and the tyres would then come back to life. So Mercedes for years haven't really suffered like they are now. So those bold strategy calls previously wouldn't have been so damaging to them as they now are, / they were in a much better position where they could sort of control and determine how the race panned out. So I'll just reiterate the question again, because I've been talking. So do you think their strategies are perhaps a fallout from the previous regulations?
I think they are. They're still writing strategies for the old sort of non-ground effect cars. They're writing strategies that sort of rely on this ability for the car's tyres to come back in, whereas a ground effects car is so much more constantly working them. You don't get that sort of second wind that they used to rely on, where sort of they'd go, you'd get Hamilton going, Bono, my tyres are gone, push through it, it's a graining phase and the tyres come back. And sure enough, they do. You just don't get that with this latest generation of cars. And they're possibly because all of their efforts have gone to trying to get the car right. They haven't been able to actually understand how to write a strategy for said car. They've been too focused on actually just...
So it's them writing a strategy for the car and situation they want to be in, not the one that they actually are in. And obviously that doesn't translate over.
Yeah, they've 100% agree, Ellie, with that, with those thoughts. Like Lewis didn't do a particularly long stint on the hards. He did 23 laps. Like Charles went longer on the medium. The Carls did 21 on the medium on the used set. So to do 23 on the hard, like when you look at the strategies, you know, it's not actually that long to run out of tires. So yes, the car's not keeping its tires. Now we saw like in Melbourne, they always had entry oversteer going into turn one, turn nine, and George crashed with entry oversteer on the last lap as well. So the car's just chewing its rear tires. So yeah, totally agree. If they have a choice between a one or a two, they should probably take the two because the car is just not in a great position at the moment.
It's interesting. We'll move on from Mercedes, who had a fairly ropey strategy, to sort of a fairly average strategy, really, from McLaren. And Timo, I'll let you open this one up again.
Yeah, it's a curious thing here because whilst looking at the results of this Grand Prix, there's a number of drivers where I was thinking, you're good, but you're limited in some respects. And Norris, for me, is again one of these drivers, a bit like Perez, that he's clearly a good driver, but unless there are significant changes, he's probably never going to be great. He appears to lack that passion I was saying about earlier that's crucial becoming one of the best, and his racecraft and his attitude on and off track have really shown that for me. And the way that, okay, you might not be fighting Red Bull for the win or even second place here, but admittedly, Carlos Sainz is on another planet at the moment in terms of his driving, but didn't seem to be much of a fight there between him and Sainz. Sainz just kind of got past him as if he was nothing. And Leclerc on this bolder strategy on tyres which shouldn't have been able to do what they've done, especially with Norris coming up behind him on arguably fresher tyres in the grand scheme of things, that should have been more of a fight that then Norris should have won. So it's a bit odd for me on that one. Norris kind of underperforming for what everyone seems to label him as one of the best drivers there's ever been. You get a lot of that, principally from McLaren people. But it's just always amusing how they give him that label, but he still hasn't won a Grand Prix or even a sprint race. Whereas Piastri, on the other hand, okay, did worse than he did last year, but completely different time of year. And he has the saving grace of it's still only his second season in F1. He's still learning very much. And this is a very difficult technical track, as we've established previously. And he would have been in P7 towards the end if it hadn't been for that one mistake towards the end where the aforementioned banana came out and caught him out. So as a team, it was kind of a very weird weekend in some respects, because it does show the benefit of switching the calendar up a bit as well, though, of Japan in October to Japan in April, and how much that can impact a team that was on the podium, double podium, to being in the top 10 just about.
I'll sort of jump in with my points, because they didn't have the overall pace they needed to execute the undercut on the Ferraris. I remember calling it quite early on. We saw them sort of come in going for the undercut, and I remember messaging my girlfriend going, Sainz has got too much pace, they can't undercut him. And sure enough, it paid out. They couldn't really undercut their way ahead of the Ferraris, and or even Perez, really. They weren't able to get too close to either of the battles that were going on towards the front. And even going up against Charles, one stop meant they were stuck between a rock and a hard place when it was fighting the Ferraris. Do they try and pick off Sainz? Do they try and pick off Leclerc? And they weren't able to come up with either the pace or the strategy to deal with either. So it was a bit of a non-possible.
So they might have had the strategy, but it just felt like Norris didn't want to try. It just seems he seemed content with it, but not in the way that Alonso's content, because he knows the car's limited and not being able to get there. You may still have lost, but it felt like he could have pushed it a bit further.
I
kind of disagree in the fact that I think Norris in some ways outperformed in qualifying to get the car in third, but didn't have the car to keep it there. It was almost a bit like how last year we consistently saw how Hülkenberg would be qualifying in the top 10, but he didn't have the car to kind of keep it there. That's how I've kind of interpreted this race for both McLarens, really. I mean, both of them lost two positions from their qualifying position. So
one position for Piastri, I think.
He qualified sixth.
It was P7 to P8. I thought he qualified P7.
I thought he qualified P6. No.
Either way,
regardless, he didn't finish where he started, he finished lower.
Yeah. they've got one lap pace, but not race pace is sort of the thing. But I'm going to side with that. I see
what you say about Hulk in the comparison, and I don't think he would have kept third for a moment, but I think it's just, it looked too easy for both of the Ferraris to get past, and considering the strategies the Ferraris were on and the mistakes that we've said that they've made, it feels like the fight should have at least gone on a bit longer, and the gap between Norris and Leclerc, they should have been slimmer. It just felt like that for me.
My final point for
Just because Martin, you're not going to get it doesn't mean you shouldn't try.
My final point for Arthur to Martin is, are we writing off Norris at the risk of simply not admitting maybe Ferrari were doing all right this weekend? It seems like we're sort of confining Norris
to the bin of not trying. I'm all optimism for Ferrari. I'm with you on the Ferrari train.
It just seems like we're sort of writing Norris off because of one slightly mid-weekend that, as I think Martin's about to point out, will be down to a fairly pants strategy.
Yeah, I think it's not fair to have a go at Lando on the strategy he was on. So he came in on lap 11 from the medium tyre. He was pretty much the first guy to pit. Your race is kind of done at that point because you haven't gone long enough on the medium tyre. Thereafter, you're going to be on old tyres. So when he was fighting the Ferraris and so on, so he's come in 13 laps later for his second pit stop. So he's done half the race. He's done two pit stops already, medium, hard. And then he's done the remainder of the race on like a long, hard stint, like a one-stop strategy. So by coming in on lap 11, it's ruined his whole afternoon. You're on the back foot straight away. If you exaggerate that example, let's say he came in on lap 5, for example, on the medium. Like you're already a pit stop down, but you're only 5 laps into the race. So he's coming on lap 11. You're a pit stop down and you're 11 laps into the race. Fernando went longer. Like we said, Charles did 26 laps on that tire. So he could have at least got to lap 20. And then, yeah, I think it's a bit harsh to have a go at him when he was probably constantly on worse tires than those around him. So I'll probably reserve judgment. We'll see how he goes.
I'll just caveat that with then of, I'm not just criticizing him in Japan, I'm criticizing him generally. And this is just the latest example, and the team obviously didn't help him in that sense. But I think as a driver as experienced as him and a team as experienced as him, they should both have potentially realized, or at least one of them should have realized, this might not be the best idea. And either way, one of them should have realized.
Yeah, there might be too much trust there from Lando to, you know, they call you in. Yes, I agree. Like, and this is where Charles and Carlos do not a bad job. So Charles called the one stop. He said, the tires are feeling good, I want to stay up. And Carlos is always, you know, he's on the radio saying no.
He makes his own strategy regardless. Yeah, he doesn't trust Ferrari.
Yeah, you might be right in saying Lando needs a little more of that fiery edge to say, guys, it's lap 11. What are you bringing me in for? Like, what are we doing here? So, Piastri came in on lap 12. So I feel like both of them really got hamstrung a lot there.
Would you say that their problem was because they retook the race start on that same set of mediums? So by lap 11 and 12, they'd already had two race starts put through them, because Alonso followed the same pit stop pattern, went two laps longer than Norris on the softs. So,
yeah, no, because the tyres had done a sector. And it, like, your strategy shouldn't really change. The only option would be to do what Mercedes did and completely get rid of that and try the double hard. But like, the Red Bulls didn't phase them. It just, you know, you've only done a lap. It's kind of different when the safety car comes out near your pit stop window and you think, should we make it and go to the end? Or, you know, have we just made a pit stop? It's essentially like the start of the race is essentially like you've just made a pit stop. And then the safety car comes out on lap 1, you've got new tyres. Like, what are you going to pit for more new tyres? So the tyres are fine. Red Bull proved that. Fernando proved that. You got Fernando going longer on the soft than Lando did on the medium, or than Oscar did on the medium. Mm. So it's definitely, yeah. And once they've come in at that point, you're kind of your race is done, really, because you're constantly on a compromised strategy. So had they executed a clean strategy, like all they had to do is divide the race up into 3 segments. All right, we're going to do 16-16 and then, you know, the remainder on the hard. So 16-16-20, that would have been fine. 16-medium, 16-medium, 20-hard. He would have been able to compete with the Ferraris with that strategy.
This one sort of fell apart from McLaren's pit wall. Meanwhile, at Aston Martin, a sort of different sort of reading of things once again. And this is possibly something exaggerated by the two different sort of clades of driver they've got in their lineup. I know that we heard a fantastic radio call from Lance Stroll that sort of was so panicked. He actually sounded a bit like sort of Shaggy from the Scooby-Doo series. There's a bit of Matthew Lillard coming through and that sort of almost squeak towards the end with the lack of pace. But a three-stop strategy was a really interesting one from Aston Martin.
All I remember is being really confused why I was seeing Stroll pit a third time to go on softs, and then he had the longest race like stint on the tires than he did on the other ones. And I know that he was struggling with his tires more. I tried to look at the Aston Martin press release for some sort of guidance on the three-stop strategy, but it didn't really give me much.
I
kind of came to the conclusion that it could have potentially been down to the fact that the two drivers had different car setups. Alonso's car had more of a qualifying trim to it, while Stroll had more downforce on his car. So perhaps it maybe hurt the tyres more, especially when you couple that with the dirty air of the other cars around him, as I'm pretty sure we saw Stroll make quite a few overtakes. And he was obviously a member of that pit lane battle when sort of four or five of them came in at once. But it was just really weird.
Yeah, he did laps 12 through, so 10 laps on a set of mediums, and then does 12 laps on a set of hards for pitting to softs to do about sort of 18 laps to the end. It was quite an odd lineup, and I think it was that, like you said, the lap 22 pit stop where he comes out on the hards. He's in that battle with Tsunoda, Magnussen and Bottas, and he just wasn't able to sort of measure his hards out and possibly just sort of overdid it a little too early. There could have even been a lockup that we might have missed on the TV feeds that would have been sort of his reason to have to sort of pit and then just go for the softs to the end, because that was the only new tyre they had left.
This won't be new, but yeah. I think Stroll is that other driver, the third driver on this list, who he's got given the car, but he's got skills nonetheless, but he does lack that passion that he needs to take that up a notch. And it was quite fun, as brief as it was, to see him wake up for one of the few times in his career towards the end of that race and start overtaking people in some very nice ways, it must be said, as weird as it is to praise him. And then it was just a bit too little too late. And on the flip side of that, you've got Alonso doing what he's been doing all season. And it's quite amusing because he's taking one round at a time. And he last year, I think it was, or the year before, he brought out this samurai-style watch as part of one of his sponsorship deals. And he seems to have taken that mindset to heart. And he's very much just cool, calm and collected, you know, one round at a time, not too fast, very happy with his driving. And we saw that again at the end of the race. He's having a great time with it and just getting on with business in hand, where Stroll's just there qualifying terribly with all these new improvements supposedly to the car. Alonso proving that he doesn't need them. He got them added onto his car, but he didn't need them because he was already outperforming him in practice, and just getting in, getting the job done, getting some points on the board and dragging Aston Martin up there, because if it was almost any other driver in that car, you'd be interested to see where Aston Martin would be, but he's doing the older generation proud.
It's almost kudos as well to Fernando Alonso, because Aston Martin came into this weekend 1 point behind Mercedes in the Constructors' Championship, and they still remain 1 point behind them after Japan, mm-hmm. despite the fact that, you know, obviously Hamilton and Russell were both in the points, and it's only Alonso's points that we can take from Japan.
Fair, they're used to Alonso being the only one of the points.
I mean, you look back at the strategies, Stroll had the longest stint of anyone in the race on those softs at the end, and that sort of almost, if he'd just held out a bit longer, he might have done fine, because they were pretty much toast by the end. And that was where he lost a place to Hülkenberg. And I think had there been another lap or two, he might have even seen Magnussen close in on him.
Fernando's done a really good job here, like you guys say, and agree with what you say, Elie May, when Stroll came in again. And you can see when you have a look at the strategies, the change of mind. Like, so he's come in on lap 12 from the medium, he's coming on lap 12 from the soft, and then 10 laps later, he's in on the medium. So they've obviously thought, I will just drop a hard and go to the end. So he's come out on the hard and he's like, this is not great. So he's come in on and then put a soft tire on and tried to go to the end. So, and that's the thing, like, if you just stick to a basic strategy, you'll be fine. Like, if you don't change your mind, like, how many people change their mind? So Leclerc changed his mind for the better. Both Mercedes changed their mind for a two-stop. Stroll's changed his mind here as well. And then McLaren, they've changed their mind as well. I don't think they plan to come in on lap 11. So if you just don't change your mind, you just execute a clean strategy, you would have found your way up there pretty well. And that's what Fernando did. It just, on paper, it just looks like a straightforward strategy. And when Lance came out on that hard tire, and he didn't like it, I think that's telling that the hard tire was just not a good tire this weekend. Like, no one put the hard on and, you know, thought that this was a great tire, except for Carlos, of course, because he had quite fresh hard tires. He had a very short stint. So again, the two Red Bulls doing medium, medium, hard was probably the way to go.
Yeah, because this was the second hardest compound of the sort of full Pirelli bunch this year, because it was the C1s. So we've still got the C0s harder still. But even then, it's not a perfectly competitive race tire, I don't think.
Have we
I thought they brought the full... Sorry, Ellie.
Sorry, have we ever seen the C0 come out? Because I don't think I've ever actually... I can't remember it.
I seem to remember them saying on commentary last year sometime that we've never actually had it, so I don't think so. Like, it's always been an option, but no one's ever used it.
Mm. I don't think it's come out just yet. I think it's always been deemed possibly that step too hard.
Yeah, so you're right in saying that out of the five tyres, these are the hardest compounds. So it wasn't that hot towards the end of the race. Anyway, a lot of teams with a lot of work to do.
Yeah, it was quite an underwhelming performance for us.
That's the one constant from this weekend.
Underwhelming. that was Aston Martin, though. When it comes to RB, Timo, we'll kick off again with your notes, because short and sweet once more.
I've got a couple of things to say, but it's essentially Mamma Mia, here we go again. And it's particularly for half of the garage, but it's interesting because on the one hand, Tsunoda, there's not really much to say because he's doing what he needs to do, kind of similar vein to Alonso, get in, get out, get the job done, maximize the potential, because let's face it, short of cars retiring ahead of him, P10 was the highest he was going to get here, especially in that car. It's in the bottom half of the grid. It's not going to drag its way up any further. So that's what's going to be there. But again, I think that whilst the weekend in the Grand Prix sense obviously didn't go the way Ricciardo wanted it to, it still plays too much. I think people are still making too much out of it in terms of they're using it to play into their narrative. He obviously didn't have any time in FP1. He had very limited and wrong conditions in FP2. He wasn't there last year because of Lawson being in the car. So he hasn't raced on this track since 2022, and that was in McLaren, and we all know how good a time that was for everyone. There was only 0.3 difference between him and Yuki in FP3, and then there was less than 0.06 between him and Yuki in qualifying when it came to the crunch time, and he was quicker than Yuki in Q1. So obviously, while we don't know where the race would ended up with all of it, both drivers had a bad start on the first actual race start, and that could have been quite easily ended up being Yuki and not Ricciardo in that position. And I wonder what people would say if Yuki had been the one to crash out instead of Ricciardo, and Ricciardo had been the one to get the 10th place. It would be, oh good, Ricciardo's got a point, but they would still kind of pile onto him and go, well, that's the least we should be expecting of him. Whereas and if Yuki crashed, I was like, oh dear, it's poor Yuki. Never mind, it's only a one-off thing. Whereas Ricciardo's not crashed this season in the race. It's just been some bad results. And it goes back to what I think I was saying in the preview, possibly, or the Australian review. I'm not sure. It's just Ricciardo, we expect more from him. Yuki, we're not sure how much more we expect from him. And it kind of inflates how well he's doing. Not taking anything away from Yuki, because he's still doing good job, and we can't really fault him for what he's doing. It's nice that he finally got a point at his home race. But I also think that the good pit stop, which Yuki himself did praise a lot of, did ultimately save him from Hülkenberg. Because if Hülkenberg had pitted a few laps earlier, I think with the pace he was gaining, Yuki towards the end, he would have had trouble keeping onto that P10. And Hülkenberg is a driver where, unlike some of the drivers that I've been talking about so far, he does have that passion and that drive to pull the maximum out of the car that he wants to, and he would have at the very least fought Yuki for that. Could have maybe forced him into a mistake. And as for the crash, I mean, it was a racing incident. I'm still going to blame Stroll for all of it because he was just in an awkward position and distracting everyone left, right, and center. And also, it was a weird place for Albon to be. I think, yeah, it is one of those lap one things, but it's kind of, I don't know where else Albon would have gone, because you're obviously not going to back off as a driver, but that also wasn't going to be a good overtaking place for it, considering where the next corner was. So it was all just a bit of a mess. But I just do wonder, if it hadn't been Ricciardo, if it had been literally any other driver, would that driver then be getting as much criticism as Ricciardo is getting? And how much does that fit into all the other stuff? And I just want to say that Owasa did a very nice job, because he did exactly what we said he should do in the previous episode, which was just go in, have a nice time. He'd finished P16. He was half a tenth behind Stroll and Bottas, all he needed to do. So nice job by Owasa, and nice to see two Japanese drivers in at least one session at the Japanese Grand Prix. So there we go.
I'll jump in with my points, because I know I can then sort of open this up to Ellie May as well. But I think there's definitely something in Danny's head at the moment. And I won't go into sort of whether or not if this was a different driver, we'd see different sort of results and public outcry and sort of discourse around it. But Yuki balked it off the line as much as Danny did. They both struggled getting that car moving on the first start. And Yuki managed to cut it back in, though, and under pressure, he was able to hold it together a little bit better. In the pack, though, Danny missed a vital check before moving and cost himself the race. And potentially this is something that I've picked up from doing motorcycle tests recently, which is before you move, you're checking. Anytime you go to make a move on a motorbike, you're checking. There is not something that you're about to turn into that's going to turn you into a pancake. And I'm going to assume there is some transference of that when you get into motor racing, where if you're going to move, if you're going to change your line, you're probably going to be at least having a quick glance to check you're not about to wipe yourself out. And there's something in that that just didn't click in that moment. In the middle of the pack, it just wasn't something that immediately fired off. I don't think blaming Stroll for being trying to send one essentially round the outside of two up into the inside of three is correct. And I blame Stroll
for being out of position in qualifying and being a bad driver generally. Just should have been there.
That's your sort of get out of jail free card for everything. And I don't think it's really Albon's fault either for trying to make a pass around the outside, which will give him the inside into four. So I think ultimately,
I think at that point it was a bit late for it. And I can see why he did it, but I think Albon should have also known better. And Stroll should know better, but we all know he's not going to know better. And Ricciardo just kind of stuck in that sandwich and goes with the racing line, and there's nowhere really to go there. So it's 3-1, and it is a racing incident at the end of the day. But no one's to blame for it particularly. It's just one of those things.
It's 3-1 to a certain extent, but ultimately you're not going to have the apex if you're the guy in the middle for either of the two corners that are coming up. So you're going to have
to make a decision.
Yeah, but ultimately the answer should not be just sort of bung it right and hope there's not someone sat on your offside, because the result is you find yourself in the barriers at lap one.
You can't bung it left, can't bung it backwards, can't go anywhere else.
Yeah, it was.
Gotta try something.
It wasn't the cleanest move, and I think there were certainly other opportunities that Danny would have had in that moment. And yeah, there could have been also simply if he had had a better start, he might not have had that problem. But Ellie May, you both agree and disagree with me.
Yeah, so I agree in that I think this is not the Daniel Ricciardo that we once are used to seeing. I think I said this in the Australian review, so sorry to everyone if I'm repeating my point, but when obviously Daniel Ricciardo went back to the Red Bull family, Christian Horner said he had picked up some bad habits that they needed to fix. But ultimately, when he did that test in Silverstone, he was very quick and they saw something in him that made them want to take out De Vries and give him then the AlphaTauri seat. And if he has learnt some bad habits, it's going to take him a while to unlearn those, but he needs support from the team to do that. Or they perhaps get an outsider, someone that isn't in his current circle, to come in and help him, because he isn't going to have all the answers on his own. He almost needs that outside perspective to give him a different, to give him that different perspective and get him back to the Daniel Ricciardo obviously everyone knows. But I think when you're saying kind of, Jesse, in that he cost himself the race, and perhaps looking at it at the instance that something is in his head, I don't think perhaps in this instance it's kind of adds to that argument. I think that, because I that's kind of almost putting a bit more blame on him. And I think firstly, Ricciardo was obviously a lot closer to Yuki in qualifying than we've seen in recent times. And he had decent pace, especially as, like you were saying, Timo, he missed a lot of practice. And secondly, I don't think I'd put any blame on either driver, to be honest. I think it was a lap one incident. Both AlphaTauri struggled to get off the line, Tsunoda more so. But sort of when Tsunoda then came back through, it kind of meant that Ricciardo was sandwiched a little bit and his teammate between his teammate and the Alpine on the left, which made him sort of a bit squiggly into turn one because he didn't quite have anywhere to go. And then that obviously allowed Stroll to come around on the outside, which Ricciardo was obviously watching out for, which made making sure that he sort of gave Stroll enough room so that they could obviously both get through the next corner. And obviously in that moment, he then didn't see Albon, which because it just, I guess, so happened that Albon obviously started on the softs. He had much better traction and grip, and I don't think he himself expected to get that good of an exit around turn one to then position himself where he was. So I think he didn't then have time to sort of back out either, and the two just kind of tangled, really. And even if they hadn't touched, I think where Suzuka is so tight, if Ricciardo hadn't have moved on, obviously left in anticipation to make it around the next corner, he would have ended up squeezing Stroll and then not leaving him enough room, and then obviously would have then taken him out. If Ricciardo then tried to back out, he could have run the risk of then having someone rear-ending him. Or if Albon, Ricciardo and Stroll then all stayed how they were, they all weren't going to get round the next corner, so obviously without contact. So I think it's just one of those unfortunate things, and I wouldn't add this instant to his current struggles he's facing.
I'll say one final thing before I give it to Martin, and that's there were two drivers across the weekend that sort of pinned out Danny Ric for that one. One of them was Ant on the commentary. He said, oh yeah, that's for me, it's a racing incident, but it's one incited by Daniel. The other one was Max watching it back in the cool down room and immediately going, oh yeah, he didn't look. If another driver is pointing out the fact that you basically made a move without looking, I think that for me is sort of...
I'd caveat that with one racing driver, because Ant Davidson, F1 career, not much to boast about there. And I think he's those who can't do maybe kind of teach occasionally on a Skypad.
The argument I would use is Perez then said afterwards, oh, Albon was in his blind spot, he wouldn't have been able to see him.
Yeah, I think there is that as a caveat, but at the same time, the fact that the check wasn't there, it's sort of inadmissible. Martin, what's your theory down on the whole sort of Minardi RB stuff?
Yeah, I'm going to have to disagree with you there, Jesse, with respect, of course. I think, Alex got a fantastic drive out of turn two, but like things happen so quickly, and all Daniel, he hasn't really changed lines. He's just absorbed the racing line and continued. So for Alex, he's all the way pinned up against the side of the track on the right, and he's got the racing line, which he knows is going to cut in front of him. At that point, you've got to get out of it. Like that's what Alex had to do there. So whilst I agree racing incident and no one to blame and all of that, I think Alex, he was the one with the drive that put himself in a closing wedge. And Daniel had a car to his left. You see his head actually look to his left. He's just absorbed the racing line, and he did not expect the car on his outside on the entry into turn three. So that's my opinion on it. Both of them got bad starts, and it's very easy. And Timo, we discussed this in our podcast. It's very easy to look at that accident and say, oh, was it Daniel? Was it Alex? Who's in the closing wedge? Was Lance involved? No. What about the starts? How about you get yourself out of that trouble and get up the grid? The starts are so complex. You've got tire temperature, when do you release the clutch, your reaction time, the revs you put in, which side of the grid you're starting on, how much fuel you start the race with. There's so many things that go into the start that they just needed to do a better job in that area.
If you look at Yuki's start as well, if Hulk didn't have such good reaction times, he could have easily just rammed straight into the back of him, and then that's race over immediately for both of them. So it's a what-if scenario, but we've seen that happen multiple times before with other drivers.
So I would go back and look at the start and say, what have we done wrong here, to then be on the back foot, to then be involved in accidents.
I agree in that it's very much, you can't just look at the incident itself. You have to look right from the start and what then caused that chain of events, because it was, you know, obviously both got poor starts. Yuki then, I guess, he had that opportunity in front of him to just keep going, and it kind of meant that it slammed the door on Ricciardo. He obviously, like I said, had the Alpine then right beside him as well. And you saw him when he sort of was going into the corner, he got very squiggly. So then he probably lost a bit of sort of momentum which obviously then didn't help when Albon then had a lot of momentum, and it was just all these sort of chain of events that sort of happened that just led to this incident.
Yeah, the only other thing I'll add is Suzuka S's is a very skinny piece of road, and the track, generally speaking, is a very skinny track. It's similar to Imola in a way. It's also a skinny track there, like where we saw George and Valtteri come together. A similar sort of thing, George going around the outside, the track goes towards the left, and then, you know, bang, there we go. So it's totally different kind of driving to like Malaysia when we used to have it. It's like 25 meters or something across, or even more. China, where we're going, is also quite a wide track. When they come down that straight, you can be easily four or five cars wide. So you just got to keep that in mind when you're doing your track walks and have a look, okay, at which point does this become skinny? And that caught George out in Imola in that wet race as well.
It's I'll take that one on the chin. That is sort of really my false call on that one. But obviously we've mentioned Alex Albon. It's probably a good point to have a look at Williams and their performance across the weekend. And Timo, you're sort of rounding out a triple of notes at this point.
Yeah, only because I'm like 80% sure they're making a third Mamma Mia film, so I feel like I can say Mamma Mia again.
I still hope they do.
Separate conversation, Ellie May. Separate conversation. It's a really odd thing because purely race result wise, it is two good outings for Albon, but that's pretty much all we can take away from the season so far. Sargeant was going pretty well for his stance before he went off, but at least he kept it out of the wall that time. But it goes back to what we were talking about after Australia. It's this whole chassis business really buggering them and making it's adding so much more pressure to them, and it really shows. I mean, Albon DNFing there, Sargeant with his crash in practice, which wasn't in qualifying, Martin, so no point for that later. I'm just jumping the gun. Just so eagerly messaging going, I called it, I'm not yet. He hasn't crashed in qualifying. It's really disappointing because they've been on the up in some respects over the last couple of seasons and making those gains forward slowly but surely. And then this year, the cards kind of, I mean, it might have good pace, but we just don't really get to see it all that often. And then when we do, it's still not quite in the points yet. It's no heroic drive from Albon to in Australia sort of thing. It's just close but no cigar. And as much as we'd like to look at the devil in the details, the results do speak for themselves quite a bit. And it's just really quite frustrating because we know that Albon at the very least can do better. And Sargeant, his confidence is going to be not great at the moment, I'd imagine, with everything after Australia, and he needed to prove himself here, and he was going all right. But again, it was just, I mean, you look at the tyre strategy, had a soft, hard, hard, medium, soft. It was just, it makes Mercedes look like they had a bit more confident of a strategy there.
Yeah, I think both the Williams drivers are under a lot of pressure. The whole team is under a lot of pressure. We've had Alex crash in Melbourne. We've had Logan's crash here in practice. We've had Alex's crash in the race. And then we've had Logan nearly crash at Degner 2 and go off deep into the gravel in the race. So that's two offs or two crashes for both drivers in two races. So I'm sure James just needs to come down and say, guys, the car's actually not that bad. Let's just complete a weekend, you know?
I think on the whole, I think it was certainly a good middle stint from Logan. It was a shame about the Degner incident, really, as his tyres were starting to work away from him and he couldn't really chase it back from there so much. But he looked a lot more comfortable in the car, chasing through the field, working the car a lot better. Just generally speaking, at home with things, even if he was running the slightly heavier repaired tub from Alex's crash in Australia. Shame about Albon, but it really emphasises the risk they're taking running sort of just the two tubs. I'm wondering at what point they go to Zach O'Sullivan and F2 and go, can we borrow that race car with the Williams livery on it? Because we're out over here, so we need another Williams racing car, and you've got one. It's an interesting incident they found themselves in.
Actually, kind of going to Zach O'Sullivan and going, get in the Williams. We can't trust these two.
That is the other ultimate option they do have. Ellie May, you've got an interesting note about Williams that I haven't actually been able to figure out what you're on about.
Okay, so in the notes I just put, don't think about a banana, but does that mean then you think about a banana?
Don't think about crashing and then you crash.
Yeah, and I think the pressure of like that in their heads this weekend, and the fact that obviously they don't have a spare chassis, it just got inside their head. I think almost for the whole team.
Yeah, it's something that's hanging over them. Hopefully once we get out the far side of China, it'll be something that's less of a problem. We'll move on to Stake, and relatively little to talk about them, but mostly because they didn't have their usual sort of level of terrible weekend. Still slow stops, still reliability proving itself as a bit of an issue, but Bottas has figured out some decent raw pace, at least. He's figured out a bit more of the chassis.
You say that, but he's still below both Alpine drivers in the championship, and that is dire.
Yeah, that is majorly dire.
In some respects, Bottas is kind of still my unofficial winner this weekend, because there were moments of where he showed sort of, I don't know, like he's quite punchy.
There were gems of Bottas of old, yeah.
Yeah, it showed Bottas of old, and we haven't really seen much of that. And you've got to think the pit stops were slow, not as slow as they were, which is a positive. But
they're still twice the length they should be, though.
Yeah, but I think without that, we might have seen an even better result from Bottas. Mm. I think it was a good race from him, regardless.
Mm.
Team, the last thing I'll say on them is that they seem to have that. Bottas seems to have that passion a driver needs, just not for Grand Prix racing.
Mm. He was out cycling as well, wasn't he, while he was in Japan? So he was having a fair good time of things. Unless we've got anything else to say about Stake, we might as well dive into Haas. And Timo, you've gone for a nice Star Wars reference, really, for your notes introduction on this one.
What have I written? Oh, yes, I have. Well, they have been, to be fair. They've been a surprise, to be sure, this season so far, but it's a very much welcome one, and I'll leave what I mean by that until later on, because I am going to spoil later on the podcast. They are my winners for this weekend, so I'll get into them there a bit. So if anyone else has anything or they want to say about them now, go for it.
Nothing really, just sort of solid weekend. No results, so it's a bit easy to brush it under the rug as a weekend, but Hulk is on exceptional form at the moment, and I'm waiting for him to do sort of a Tsunoda and work his way into that top 10 as the one driver that infiltrates the top 10 and proves
his the last metal. Two races.
Mm. Very much so.
They're just continuing to have almost sort of a very consistent season. Both drivers are doing well. The car is doing a lot better than most people thought, and it doesn't appear to be race specific either, so it's definitely promising stuff, and it gives them a good base to go off and improve.
Mm, there's a consistency coming through, something that could also be said about Alpine. They are just being consistently terrible and slow.
I don't know what there is to say. It might be a great villain era story for Gasly or Ocon.
Except they'll be the villain that gets killed off in the first 5 minutes of a Bond film because they're that irrelevant.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I could do better with my 1970s MG, and I have blown the engine up on that. So, I mean, you'd be quicker off running a Grand Prix at this point in time.
Yeah, I think Ocon's done a good job in qualifying, at least. So, yeah, he made it into Q2, yeah?
Yeah. It was quite amusing, actually, seeing him do that, then get up to, what, P11, and then think, oh, Christ, he might actually do this, and then just, bam, straight down to P15 again. Oh, yeah. Never mind. But he tried.
He's trying, yeah.
Yeah, there's something on the horizon for Alpine. It's either leaving F1 or suddenly getting better, but we'll have to wait and figure out what that one is. So with all the teams covered over, we'll dive into our winners and spinners before this podcast goes on for too much longer. And Timo, you've already teased them a little bit. Your winners of Haas.
Yeah, it's got to be Haas because Magnussen, admittedly, bad qualifying, but good recovery race and doing what he needs to do there. And similar to what I was saying about Ferrari earlier, two of them seem to be working quite nicely together. There's no bullshit between the two of them. They're just getting on with the job in hand and maximising their potential. We saw that in Saudi, we saw that in Australia, and we've seen it here a bit now. Hülkenberg was definitely the quicker car. Magnussen didn't really hold him up. And Hülkenberg, I'm going to go back to the theme that I've been saying about a lot this episode. He's a driver who does have that passion and skill that's needed to be a great racing driver. He just has always been at the wrong place at the wrong time, unfortunately, to capitalise on it. And at the moment, he's reminding me of Alonso in his second stint at McLaren of that car should not be getting to the places where it's getting, but because of the driver that's in it, it is managing to get there. And as I said earlier, had they pitted him a few laps earlier, I think he would have got Yuki for P10, and that is pretty brilliant for Haas. And think that they're going to be Minardi's kind of biggest threat this season, and they are very much the underdog. We love an underdog story. So doing a surprisingly good job, surprising no one probably more than themselves in this one. And it's just quite refreshing to see. I don't like that it's necessarily at the expense of Williams, because I don't want that to be the trade-off, but it's nice that someone different is coming up in that way. And it's not quite as much as we wanted it in this new era of racing that we're supposed to get the closeness of it, but at least there's something that we can take from that.
I'll jump onto my winner quickly, because I've already sort of waxed lyrical about Ferrari and the fact that while it wasn't a perfect weekend for them, it was a good weekend given their sort of previous track record in, say, the last sort of 2 or 3 years for their ability to sort of put together a solid pit strategy across a race. And equally, that does give me a great chance to go to Ellie May and your winner of Sainz.
Yeah, any race he's finished, he's got a podium, and the only other driver to do that is Verstappen. The man is on a roll, and in the words of School of Rock, he's sticking it to the man. And to quote them again, if you're not hardcore, you're not hardcore unless you live hardcore, and he is doing just that. He's only 4 points behind Leclerc and 9 points behind Perez in the Drivers' Championship, despite missing a race. Equally, Verstappen has a 13-point lead ahead of Perez, despite not scoring any points in Australia.
Yeah, it's a good drive from him. Martin, your winners.
Yeah, I've just changed it. Obviously, Ferrari, top three have all done a solid job. But I think Fernando's a big winner in this one. You know, executed not a bad strategy. Strong pace, drag that Aston Martin up the front. And Yuki as well for getting a point in his home Grand Prix.
Pretty good.
The one thing that annoyed me about, there are several things that annoyed me about the Sky commentary. Like, they kept saying he's going to get his first points in Japan. Like, point. 10th place, 1 point. They haven't changed it. I know it's finicky, but English language, your English presenters, get your damn tenses right.
But it's finishing in the points, which is the cumulative number.
Yeah, but he's only getting a point, and they know that.
It's dropping the participle to just call it a points finish. Anyway, we'll stop splitting hairs on that and jump into spinners. And I'll say my one. We've already really spoken about him. It's Danny Ric. I still think there's definitely something in his head. And if he can't come out on top of Yuki in China, a track Tsunoda hasn't raced before, then I think we know there's certainly something that's a little bit up there, especially as he's taking upgrades and a new chassis for it, which should rebuild a bit of confidence, give him this scope. He's gone well in China before. He's won in China before. I think it's one of the first times we saw him with the Shoei celebration, and it's a big wide track, so there's no chance for him to ram Alex there. I may have a slight bias for Alex Albon. Timo, your spinner, which is quite obvious really given your track record of talking about this boy.
To be fair, I've not chosen him for a while, but considering how shocking it was this weekend, it had to be Lance Stroll really. Updates on the car, didn't do anything with them. Qualifying, awful. Woke up at the end of the Grand Prix, one of the few times in his racing career where he's remembered he's a Grand Prix driver, and then he's on the softs, cooks it too soon, and falls down in Hülkenberg. No offense to Hülkenberg, but Hülkenberg in a Haas overtakes an Aston Martin on pace on hard tyres. Get out.
Yeah. Ellie May, you've got a fairly obvious spinner, dare I say.
Alpine, I've never seen anything so painful in my
Putting
life.
A fish in a barrel.
Yeah. Everyone overtook those Alpines so easily.
There's no straight line speed. There's no corner speed. There's
no speed.
Not even average. It's so far beyond subpar. It's laughable, really, at this point. Martin, though, you've put a bit of thought into your spinners. They're certainly ones that we've talked about previously, and you've given some cracking insight on. So it makes sense that they are sort of crowned your spinners from this weekend.
Yeah, I think for world championship teams, like the might of Mercedes and the might and history of McLaren, they don't have excuses really for those sort of strategies. So I think they need to have a look into their department and see what can be done there, because like I said, for their history and competence and level of excellence that those two teams represent, we expect better strategies from them, like similar to what Red Bull have done here.
It's sort of the inverse to my Ferrari winner, where we're used to Ferrari being terrible and then they've done a good one. This is McLaren and Mercedes, usually pretty solid, and have absolutely sort of pantsed this one. New little section that sort of fits in with winners and spinners, which is girlfriend gossip. After she stood in with winners and spinners for me the other week, my girlfriend's back with them. Georgia said, winner, Yuki slapped about Danny Ric, and spinner, Alpine. Drivers are quick, but the car is garbage. And we did see the drivers putting in a good show of actually trying to race. But yeah. We've yet to prove anything with that car. We'll dive into the predictions review and 0 points for Timo this week. Ellie May and I stay in lockstep, however, both scoring 2 points apiece, myself for fastest lap and Logan finishing ahead of Albon. I really didn't expect that one to come through. Ellie May for pole and win. Martin dominating with, well, this one I think we're going to have to argue it out quickly, either 5 points or four points. Verstappen pole win and the fastest lap plus Sainz P3. So, but he also had the wild prediction of crashes from experienced drivers. He didn't specify qualifying.
I did specify qualifying.
But on the proviso that, you know, that's when they're going to be pushing and under pressure. Logan's just happened to do it for me a little bit earlier.
Crashes in qualifying, particularly from inexperienced drivers, not experienced. Yeah, could be Logan, could be Lance. I like that you put Lance in experienced. That makes me amused. And then there we go. But yeah.
All right, I'll update the spreadsheet.
Logan was in there, yeah.
There's no difference to me. I'm not going to win this anyway, but just for the sake of...
I think the main takeaway was, you know, I know that the Suzuka track is like that. And if you're under pressure, inexperienced, a crash will come. That was my main... And a red flag will be brought out. And that was my main thought and direction there. And I think we saw that with Logan. You know, Yeah. It's interesting because that's a really long corner as you come up through the hill there. I think it's got a name, but I can't remember the name of that one.
Dunlop.
Yeah. So, and when you're turning and you recognize the car's not turning and you've got understeer, you need to get out of the throttle.
Yeah.
And he's just kept his foot in that for no apparent reason. So it's just a very strange one to do in a first practice session around Suzuka. Like the maturity's not there. The coaching's not there. The attention to detail is not there. There are so many things like the professionalism is not there. The awareness that Williams are, you know, only bringing one chassis to these tracks is not there. There's a lot of insight into that one for me. Mm.
There was an interesting sort of chat about it on Twitter. There was a lot of people going, oh yeah, but you can see the car is understeering. And I'm going, yeah, but who's driving the car? Who's made it understeer and who's got the chance to make it stop doing that by simply getting out the throttle?
Yeah, get out of the throttle.
Unfortunately, at that point, the answer does lie with Logan. So overall...
5 second penalty for Ocon, I reckon.
Yeah. So overall, it's Timo still on nil. The guest, as a sort of cumulative guest score, is now actually on 4. Ellie May and I, though, remain on a complete tie on 8 points. We'll jump onto our Fantasy F1 review, quite an interesting week this week. The highest scorer was Jaden Azula. I don't know how to spell that name.
How he managed to afford that team.
Yeah, that's what I'm really surprised.
He must have done that pre-season, but even then, that's really tight.
They must have had chips activated, no?
They must have had something activated to get Verstappen, Perez, Sainz, Leclerc, Norris, Ferrari and Red Bull as their lineup. But yeah, 372 points. It's actually tied with Noah Honga, who's got the same lineup. So curious there. Might have to check back to see if there's been any suspicious trading going on. The highest of our teams, Ellie May in 13th, 208 points scored this weekend, just ahead of my Jaffa Cake Racing lineup.
Do you not want to say my team's name?
No, I think that one was just Ellie May's or Extra Magnificent Terrestrial, that one, I believe.
Again.
Overall, John Sealer locks out the top two spots, tying his two teams on 888 points with What's the Racing Point and Take a Stroll. The highest of our teams overall is Ellie May's podcast team, actually, in 9th on 745, which brilliantly brings us to the end of our review of the Japanese Grand Prix. Quite a long one, but certainly some interesting strategies to put apart. In the meantime, though, we'll be back ahead of the Chinese Grand Prix as we return to Shanghai for the first time since F1000, a point where Max Verstappen only had something like 5 Grand Prix wins. Now he's got 3 world championships and we're heading back for the first time in what feels like donkey's years. Anyway, in the meantime, where can the people find you, Martin?
All social media, Lower Lap Time, and for all coaching products, lowerlaptime.com.
Perfect. Ellie May, where can the people find you? Although you look like you had a final point to chuck in.
No.
No? You're just stretching. You weren't raising your hand. You were just stretching.
No, I was just stretching. Sorry. You can find me still on the podcast Instagram doing my Women in Motorsport series. I had a little bit of a hiatus last week, but I will be back.
Greetings.
And Timo, where can the people find you?
Is it Flask on the Curves, Paddock Sorority, Natural RX, all the usual places?
Good stuff. And in the meantime, if you want more of me, you can find me writing for Classic Car Weekly. Our latest issue will go to press Wednesday, so it will be probably out when you hear this, or wait for it to pop out. It will be there. And you can also find me on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok as at Jesse on Cars. There's all sorts of car content coming up on there, including Goodwood members meeting, 81st members meet. I'll be there this weekend. Plenty of fantastic racing action with some big names appearing in that too. So a lot of really nice stuff coming up there. Anyway, we'll be back ahead of the Chinese Grand Prix. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.